to the minefield.
It's wonderful to have your company today as we do what we normally try to do, and that is negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my always excitable co-host.
Excitable, not exciting. Doesn't that mean that I'm a bit sort of frenetic and easily riled?
I didn't say you were not exciting.
Okay.
You've decided to read that omission as being a statement.
It's true.
Yeah.
Declaration
by omission is, it's a very complicated legal maneuver that you've tried to pull there, Scott. I'm not going to acquiesce to it.
I do have notoriously thin skin, so I'll try to... Anyway, let's leave that behind. Look, it's become, I think, politically and publicly quite suspicious, I think you would agree, Wally, to make big declarations about the great moral and political challenges of our time after a fairly renowned Australian leader did that concerning climate change not that long ago, only yes. to then dial back altogether on any attempt to tackle that particular policy. But, you know, I'm maybe a little bit of a public figure, but I'm certainly not a political one. So what the hell? Let me try to make just such a declaration. It seems to me, Waleed, that inequality is, in fact, the defining social and economic reality of our time. And it's one of those wicked problems in the proper moral and philosophical sense. The deeper you go into the problem of inequality, the more intractable, the more difficult, the more insoluble it seems to get. And yet it can hardly be disputed that over the last 50 years, more than 80% of the wealth of advanced nations has accumulated to the top 10%. If we put that onto a more global stage, the percentages of that disparity get even more soul-destroying. And yet, one of the interesting things, I think, like any of the pathologies that have grown up under the conditions of modern capitalism, this particular pathology, the problem of massive wealth disparity, has in fact mutated, especially over the last two decades, where it's not simply that some people have more money and other people have less. Instead, it's that there is mass structural disparity as well. It's not just that there's some that are rich and some that are poor, but that the rich and the poor in a single country and the rich nations and the poor nations seem increasingly to occupy different worlds. In other words, inequality has gone from mere economics to being almost ontology, people occupying different existences. It was interesting to me, Waleed, I'm not sure if you picked this up, but just towards the beginning of his second term in office, U.S. President Barack Obama, quite singularly, I thought, flagged inequality as being a particular wound, if you like, on America's civic fabric, and put it in terms that I thought were really, morally speaking, quite interesting.
Now, the idea that so many children are born into poverty in the wealthiest nation on earth is heartbreaking enough. But the idea that a child may never be able to escape that poverty because she lacks a decent education or health care, or a community that views her future as their own, that should offend all of us.
That was Barack Obama, former U.S. president, speaking in 2015. I don't know about you, but that makes me a little bit nostalgic for a president that can actually form complete sentences, Wally.
Look at you. The cynical outer crust of Scott Stevens has been penetrated in just a few months.
I don't know. I'm just a bit, you know, sort of fluttery at the moment. So look, here's the way I want to pitch this to you, and then I'm entirely in your hands. Most of the public policy criticism of widening inequality over the last few years, and here I think particularly of someone like Joseph Stiglitz, even Thomas Piketty, they focused primarily on the political and policy decisions that have allowed this kind of mass disparity to arise. And I think that's right to do so. There really have been some astonishing political maneuvers that have been made since the mid-1970s. But I think one of my concerns is that focusing on the political decisions tends to give us a bit of an alibi, because one of the reasons that those political decisions in the first place could be made and then sold to the public is for certain moral degeneration to take place, a moral shift in our structure of feeling whereby inequality no longer offended us, no longer cut at the very fabric of the civic body, of the civic cloth, in the way that it used to. In other words, there is a moral change. What I'd like to suggest to you, Waleed, is at the heart of that moral change in us that stopped inequality from being as offensive as it once was, one of the big changes that had to take place is for poverty itself to become moralized. In other words, instead of poverty being a matter of luck, You know, destitution is something that can overtake anybody, which was the predominant sentiment in the two decades following the Second World War. Instead, poverty becomes a personal failing. If I'm poor, it's because I'm addicted. It's because I'm not sufficiently industrious. It's because I've somehow broken faith with the very terms of the civic contract. And once that's done, then the language of individual responsibility instead of mutual accountability or mutual interdependence becomes the order of the day. What do you think? Does this feel like a correct reading of the moral terrain of the last half century, or do you think I'm on thin ice?
No, I think you're right. I think the reason that Barack Obama found the thought of someone being born into poverty and not being able to escape it in the richest country in the world so devastating is that on some level it runs so counter to the American mythology.
That's
which
right.
is that just is not possible. Land of opportunity, anyone can be anything. It's one of the reasons there's this cultural love of billionaires, because it represents the possibilities of the aspirations of people. And that narrative has started to collapse, and I think you're right. And there is a very dark side to that narrative, which is, as you've described, that if anyone can achieve anything because there's a land of opportunity, then the narrative, the corollary of that is that those who don't achieve have not grasped that opportunity. And so there's a kind of, actually a bit of a, in some ways, a re-articulation, although not necessarily conscious, of that kind of medieval idea that in life each man gets as he deserves.
Yes.
It's a very strange thing, except this is done via a market mechanism. And because of that is seen as so much more plausible, so much more obvious as a law of nature, that if this is merely a contest for resources between us and we are all free to pursue our own ends, then those who cannot accrue those resources really have nowhere to look but themselves. And this is the structural contradiction that, who was it? I keep forgetting when I go to say this, who said it. It might have been Lichtman, I'm not sure. But the structural contradiction that is at the heart of modern capitalism is this idea of dependent independence.
We
have a mythology of complete independence in the way that we go about things. You are an individual who pursues your own ends, and so what you achieve is yours, and what you do not achieve, therefore, is yours as well. And in the process, we overlook the truth of the matter, which is that we are deeply interdependent, that we require someone to deign to give us that opportunity, that job, or whatever it might be, or we require certain forms of cultural capital in order to access other economic capital. That's the way that life works. But because we have no narrative to tell ourselves about this, when we fail, there is nothing to catch us except the feeling of our own failure. And that can become deeply destabilizing. It can precipitate an existential crisis of some sort, because you have nothing except failure. There's nothing there. And so, to some extent, I think the crisis of inequality, there is a material dimension to it, in that there are people who are in poverty, for example, and no narrative can rescue them from the fact that they're in poverty. If they can't feed themselves, then there's a hard boundary there, right? That's obvious. But I think beyond that, it's a crisis of narrative. It's that we have no way to explain inequality. It's not the mere fact of it. It's that those who are at the bottom end of the income spectrum or the wealth spectrum have no story that they can tell themselves to give themselves meaning. And in the absence of that, I think inequality becomes really radioactive, despite the fact that we have been living in a society that has proceeded upon a narrative that presumes that inequality is no bad thing, in fact, might be an essential productive force. And as we see that begin to crash upon the shores of reality, we now need to think of another way of understanding the inequality amongst us, because we can't fix it instantly. It would take massive, quite radical political reorganization to fix inequality, to eradicate it. So in the meantime, we need a way of explaining it to ourselves, and we've sort of eroded all the, I don't know, the political, the even the theological resources that we might have once had to try to do that.
I think that's right. And look, just to point out one quick thing, though, Waleed, that was so interesting about that post-war period was that inequality or poverty was viewed as something that really was contingent. This is something that really could overtake anybody. So this kind of shared commitment to social insurance, the idea that any of us could be in this position, therefore we need to assist anybody who is in that position, because that could in fact be us. That moral commitment to fundamental human equality, as instantiated in the, you know, as sort of embedded, if you like, in the varied existences of human beings in a serried and unequal economic circumstance, you know, that I think was fundamental. One of the things that we've seen then in recent years is that the very lived experience of massive inequality, I would suspect, Wally, that that's actually begun to erode our very normative commitment to fundamental human equality itself. We cannot help but see people as less than us, as fundamentally less than people themselves, and therefore really not deserving any kind of social benefit.
Yeah, because we don't understand ourselves as being the bearers of obligations.
That's right. Yeah.
As being the beneficiaries of something that is in some ways arbitrary, and therefore an obligation being attached to it. We've discussed this before in the context of aristocracy, in the way in which one of the things you could say for aristocracy was that at least it imposed a kind of noblesse oblige. It imposed an obligation on the aristocracy to be patrons or custodians of those who were below them in the social order, from which I suppose we get the term patronizing. Because and the reason patronizing is an insult is that it implies an inequality. But in a system that was kind of stratified in that way, the inequality was taken as a given. What mattered was whether or not you played your role within that stratification appropriately. And that would necessarily mean that you would have to fulfill certain obligations. Yep. So it's a different sort of a narrative. And I suppose the question becomes, what narrative do we have for the future in dealing with this if all the narratives of past and even present collapsing before our eyes? I'm not about to answer that because I can't. You're listening to The Mindfield. You can find us by, all sorts of ways. You can listen to us live on the radio. You can listen to us by streaming on the radio app, or you can download the podcast, which is a wonderful thing to do because you get a little podcast extra, an extra 10 or so minutes where we talk about the stuff we just didn't have time to get to, really. And it'll be wonderful to have your ears.
Look, I can hardly get over my job most weeks. The idea that people who I've read and profited immensely from, we get to then have on the show. Our guest is one such person. Yasha Monk is lecturer in political theory in the Department of Government at Harvard University. He's also the author of, to my mind, one of the most important books of political philosophy of the last decade, and certainly one of the finest books to be published this year. It's called The Age of Responsibility, Luck, Choice, and the Welfare State. And he joins us in the wee hours of the morning via Skype from London. Hello, Yasha.
Hi, I'm glad that after talking me up so much, you gave me an excuse if I just, you know, waffle incoherently at 2 a.m. here.
That's exactly right. And look, I should also say that Yasha also runs a wonderful little podcast called The Good Fight. We'll include links on our website. Yasha, I want to put to you, you know, you teach at Harvard, so you actually sort of come intellectually from the belly of the Rawlsian beast. So if you don't mind me putting a bit of John Rawls to you, one of the things that's often missed within John Rawls's political philosophy is, yes, he had this commitment to the institutions of procedural justice, and yet he was at the same time was convinced that those institutions of just distribution and redistribution had to be sustained by the cultivation of the proper moral sentiments to make those institutions work, to cause people to recoil, if you like, from gross inequity. Is it too much to say that the failure of the institutions of welfareism was fundamentally a failure not to cultivate the ongoing moral commitments of the citizens to the very principles that welfare institutions were meant to safeguard?
Yeah, I think there's a sort of symbiosis in a just society between institutional arrangements that provide some amount of social equality and thereby encourage the sentiments you need for equality, like mutual respect, like a recognition that every member of a society can really be a full agent in their own right, like enough common experiences to see the humanity in each other. And then the fact that people have these feelings makes it easier to sustain those kinds of institutions of redistribution and investment in the education of all citizens and so on. And so perhaps there's a danger, conversely, that once you slip away from that society, you enter a vicious cycle, where because inequality keeps increasing, because the station in life that the lucky enjoy is so different from the station in life that most others in society have, because they so rarely have the same experiences. They think, well, why should I help these people? You know, I think we're just probably being lazy or irresponsible, and so let's ignore their claims, and that then further increases the social inequality. So I guess my way of thinking about it would be putting these two terms into conversation with each other.
I wonder then, to what extent this was inevitable once these forms of obligation and solidarity and the moral and emotional commitments to one another that we might have wanted to cultivate, once they were institutionalized and thereby depersonalized, did they ever have a chance? That, don't get me wrong, I'm glad they were institutionalized because I think it was important to have a systematization of these things that meant they were applied in a plenary fashion, or at least that was the idea. But once things become impersonal, do they suddenly have a shelf life?
Huh. So that would nearly suggest that there's a sort of, you were talking earlier about the sort of structural contradictions of capitalism, and this is sort of a cultural contradiction of a welfare state.
Yeah.
That, you know, you get the welfare state because people come from, you know, quote unquote, organic communities, sort of little villages and towns where they know each other, they have common experiences, and so they think, well, when, you know, misfortune strikes one of us, we should help them, and we should do that not just by sort of bringing around some dinner for them, but by institutionalizing it. And that may be the origin of some of the welfare states in that account. And then as the welfare states actually sort of overcome the need for that kind of fellow feeling on a day-to-day basis, because you think, well, the state's going to take care of that, you slowly reduce the willingness of people to be solidaristic like that with each other. I don't know if that's true, but it's a fascinating hypothesis.
But well, the argument would go something like this. I care for you and therefore I have to look after you personally, to let's do this in an institutional way so that my care for you is automatic, to this is now an institution looking after this, therefore not my problem, to why am I giving up my wealth for this institution again?
Right.
And I think what's so interesting about that, you know, if we sort of pivot for a moment to Thomas Piketty's, I think, bracing hypothesis in Capital, it's that the Second World War created artificial conditions within the bubble of historical capitalism, that essentially it created almost national villages where we had this heightened but fundamentally artificial sense of solidarity with one another. And that then everyone being willing to lean into taxation as a fundamental moral act, as taxation as itself central to a moral society, to a just society. But that once that sense of post-war solidarity eroded, all we were left with were these burdensome institutions. And I think, Yasha, what's so compelling to me then about your diagnosis is the way that in the mid-1970s, the language of individual responsibility rather than sort of mutual interdependence came to take center stage within political rhetoric.
Yeah, one of the great achievements, by the way, of Piketty is precisely to make us see what we took as the natural state of politics, the, you know, what the French call the Trente Glorieuses, the 30 sort of wonderful post-war years of great prosperity and full employment. And, you know, all politicians had to think about is how do we expand the welfare state? Whom do we give a present first? And we started to take for granted that this is the normal state of politics. And the further we get away from that moment, the more we might start to recognize that it was actually quite an extraordinary moment, both economically in terms of very fast growth rates and politically and culturally. The kind of cohesive societies were produced both by the experience of war and the threat of fascism and communism and by that affluence, right? And so you slowly move out of those decades. They create problems of their own. The welfare state starts to look stagnant. Economic growth slows. The only problem in politics no longer is how do we divide sort of increase in the pie, but it's actually more ferocious distributive battles when the growth stalls. And you start getting this fundamental transformation that you see across political philosophy, moral philosophy, sociology, criminology, and all of these different fields, where people start saying, well, shouldn't we really think about individual responsibility? Shouldn't we rethink society in such a way that egalitarians no longer just judge a society by how equal it is, by the Gini coefficient, by what the pattern is that you can find by looking at its present state, but by whether or not there's historical justice, by which they mean, is it true that if you're poor, it's because of the choices you've made? Is it true that if you're rich, it's because you've been so entrepreneurial and hardworking? And if that's true, if that's the case, then perhaps the society is really just, even if there's vast material inequalities.
But going back to this idea that you mentioned, Scott, about the artificially large village, I suppose you might say, after World War II, doesn't that help us explain why it is that the welfare state struggles so much in the face of mass immigration? Because what you must do, surely, if you're going to commit to a welfare state and have that sense of solidarity, is it's an extension of family. You are saying that these are our people, they look like us, they behave like us, and so on. And it's on that basis that the solidarity is extended beyond the personal. Right? I'm looking for an analogy or a metaphor that I can transpose onto an impersonal relationship to make it personal. Once you have mass immigration, that transposition becomes more and more difficult. You need some kind of civil idea to connect it. But of course, the fundamental idea at the heart of the solidarity that undergirds the welfare state was not a civil idea really, so much as a familial one, it seems. And so was there anywhere that the welfare state could go? I mean, once it became depersonalized, as it was inevitably going to, and once it had to face up to the unfamilial bonds that migration necessarily imposes upon us, how could it survive? How would you have imbued it with some kind of moral character that would have allowed it to survive the kind of instincts of human beings?
Wally, I think that's fabulous. I've got a risky hypothesis that I want to run past you both that I've not done in any other setting. So, you know, it may be completely bogus, but here goes. It seems to me that the welfare state was actually, in the two decades following the war, was surprisingly accommodating to refugees, to mass migration. And that was because, I would suggest, of both the institutional architecture, but also the moral, the sentimental, the affective architecture. One of the things that we see in the mid-1970s with the erosion of the welfare state and the commitment to social insurance, and part of that, I should say, was due to the influx of foreign and migrant workers. So that was something that sort of helped erode, I think, many of the commitments that were bound up with trade unions and so forth. But one of the things we see from the mid-1970s is the production of a series of exemptions from the social contract. So if you are a welfare cheat, if you are a free rider, and then, say, in France, if you are among the sans-papiers, those who are sort of illegal foreign workers, you gradually exempt yourself from any claim on social benefits. So I would suggest, Waleed and Yasha, that it's actually the beginning of the creation of exemptions from these common bonds that then precipitated much of that erosion that we've then come to see in our commitment to refugees and migrants, which has then led to the dissolution of the very bonds of solidarity itself.
Well, I think what this shows is that there really are sort of virtuous equilibria and pernicious equilibria. That in the idea of a universal welfare state that perhaps is better adapt at including immigrants within it, opposed to the idea of much more selective welfare state that punishes people if they've made the wrong choices and that sits in judgment of people and perhaps is also more hostile of outsiders coming in. You know, you sort of in one world or in the other. And once you start leaving the virtuous world, it's quite easy to have forces reinforce each other and pull you towards a much less forgiving idea of a welfare state. And that's one of the fundamental transformations, I think, of how the welfare state looks in many countries now, in the United States, in Australia, and in large parts of Western Europe. Sorry, there's music or something in the background as well.
Yeah, that just means that the news fairies are about to kick us off the radio, Yasha. But we'll continue this conversation in the podcast because I think you've opened up a fertile ground for exploration.
Absolutely.
Yasha Monk is a lecturer on political theory in the Department of Government at Harvard University. And we are done for the week, but hang around now for the podcast if that's how you're hearing us.
Yasha, just picking up precisely on the point that you just raised, you in your book, you diagnose that the introduction of the language of responsibility was most likely pernicious, to use the term, to use the category judgment that you've just made. And yet within interconnected societies, and certainly within welfareism generally, responsibility cannot be wholly done without. There is a place. So it's not so much responsibility versus whatever, but it's different meanings that are given to responsibility itself.
Yeah, so when politicians used to talk about responsibility, what they meant is a pretty rich moral concept that included lots of duties to other people. John F. Kennedy didn't say the word responsibility in his famous inaugural speech, but that's what he was talking about when he said, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. There's a genuine sense of obligation towards your family, your neighbors, your fellow citizens. And that's slowly gone away. We've sort of reduced and boiled down the notion of responsibility to a pretty harsh and punitive core. When we talk about individual responsibility, personal responsibility in politics and in discussion of a welfare state now, what we really mean is this. If you are in need for reasons that are beyond your control, that have nothing to do with what you can do, because, for example, you were born disabled or you had a terrible car accident, then we might owe you something. That's you're virtuous, you didn't act irresponsibly, the state should help you. But if the only reason why you're in need is that you've made bad choices, that you did act irresponsible, that you failed to live up to your personal responsibility, then perhaps we don't owe you anything. You should fend for yourself. Now, to some degree, that's understandable. Why should we help people who've made the bad choices? Why should we help people who don't want to help themselves? I understand the moral instinct that lies behind that. But I think that it often makes us quite cruel. And it often blinds us to the straightforward benefits of a more generous welfare state. So if you don't treat people who don't take out health insurance, as now often happens in the United States, you end up with certain communicable diseases spreading much more because people don't get treatment for it. And in the end, the healthcare system is much more expensive for everybody. That's a terrible idea. And so, you know, I think we need to think about how do you construct a more positive idea of responsibility, one where perhaps certain aspects of a welfare state can be conditional. Sometimes you might say, well, look, if you consistently make bad choices, if you really don't want to contribute to society in any way, we'll cut you off. I'm not entirely opposed to that. But a notion where actually we start to reconceive of responsibility as a positive good, but we want to help empower people to take agency over their own life, to take on duties for others, to rethink responsibility in this broader sense.
But what about the concept of a moral preparedness not to punish for mistakes, not to punish for bad decisions that have been made? I mean, I completely understand a moral commitment not to reward those who are cheating somehow or rorting or trying in some way to abuse the society that is assisting them. But the very thought that a mistake is enough to disqualify you, it seems to me, it completely ignores human nature. And it attributes to one of our to ourselves some kind of superhero capacity, this kind of perfectible human being who can only be entitled to things as long as they live up to that perfection, which is, of course, is completely inhuman.
Yeah, so this idea of choice that is really crucial to this, right? In order to make the idea of personal responsibility work, you have to distinguish between what did somebody choose to do and what is outside of their control? And the things that you choose to do, you have responsibility for. And the things that are outside of your control, you don't. That's a basic philosophical construct. You know, that leads you, that distinction leads you to examine people's lives in a way that's really quite artificial. What does it mean to have chosen to drop out of high school or university if, you know, you live under really difficult circumstances and you have to look after your parents and, you know, unless you earn money, they're going to not have food on the table, right? I mean, perhaps it is somehow your responsibility that you wind up not being very qualified and you lose your job later because it was your choices. But that depends on what kind of choice that you have. So it focuses in our attention to these really narrow questions, instead of thinking about the things that I want to think about, which is, well, look, how do you start designing a welfare state? What are the larger political trade-offs? Do we want a society that avoids needless cruelty and needless suffering, that protects people even if they have made some mistakes? Those are really good reasons for a generous welfare state. And then there are some reasons to make institutions conditional to some degree, right? There are reasons to say, well, look, perhaps if we spend too much money on the welfare state, taxation is too high, we're not going to have a lot of economic growth, or we're not going to live in a really vibrant entrepreneurial society. Now, that's a real trade-off. No amount of political philosophy is going to wish that trade-off away. But that's at least a sensible way of thinking about what kind of society do we want to construct? What are the goals of our institutions? Why do we want a welfare state in the first place? And instead we ask these really weird, moralized questions that poses all of those bizarre hypotheticals. You know, if this guy hadn't dropped out of high school back then, would he now have a job? And if he did, what would it be? You know, it becomes incredibly complicated, and it just diverts our attention to things that to me don't matter so much.
There's a very dear friend of mine is a very, very, very fine moral philosopher. He's also a militant pacifist, if I can put it that way, or he's militantly committed to nonviolence. One of the points that he made in a book some years ago is that soldiers going to war have to make a fundamental sacrifice. And that fundamental sacrifice is the ordinary human refusal to kill, to take the life of another. It seems to me that one of the things that we've seen over the last 3 decades is a social sacrifice. And that is the sacrifice that might have been cultivated, but maybe not sufficiently nurtured during the post-war period, which was a more fundamental moral refusal to profit at the expense of others. In other words, there is actually something kind of affective about this, the acquired immunity that we've gained from the needs of others. And I'm just wondering, you know, the public spaces, the spaces themselves where we'd be confronted with the sheer humanity of our fellow citizens, or the shared humanity of these people that belong to the same political community. With these public spaces increasingly dwindling and us becoming increasingly segregated in our own communities of like-minded and like socioeconomically statused people, I'm just wondering how where are those spaces, or where are those mechanisms or those institutions whereby we can come to recultivate this sense of the shared humanity of others, where we can feel, if you like, as if we belong to the same political community?
Well, let me say something negative and something positive. The negative thing is that there's a sort of standard response to a lot of the stuff that I've talked about. It's a response that, you know, coming from the political left, I sort of grew up with, and but I think is pretty instinctive to a lot of people. And it is to say, look, faced with this rhetoric of responsibility, and faced especially with a political right that wants to say, look, you've made a bad choice, your problem, we don't care about you, the easiest solution is to say, well, you know what? Actually, most people aren't responsible for their choices, because there's all of these structural determinants of their lives. It's not their fault. They don't really have freedom of choice, or they are in situations where we don't have any real alternatives. And we should always think of people as these sort of victims that don't have any real agency. And to me, that's quite pernicious, to use that term again, as well, because it really discounts our shared humanity. It's not actually an expression of equality at all. It's not an expression of mutual respect. It's not a recognition of our fellow citizens as being beings who potentially are capable of agency. Instead, it's saying, oh, these poor victims, you know, they are too incapable, they're too far from sort of the mainstream of society to ever be able to achieve anything anyway. So let's give them a little bit of welfare, let's help them a little bit, and not actually try to have them be participants in the same polity, in the same society, will sort of keep them quiet. And so I think that's one thing we have to do. Have to overcome the idea that a simple solution to this social distance is to sort of have pity for people and think that they're victims of larger circumstances and forget about their own desire to be real agents. But the second is, and that's the positive thing I want to say, to actually think about how do you create common bonds in a society? How do you create common experiences? How do you make sure that people might have huge inequalities in some forms of material wealth. If somebody owns 10 Rolexes and I don't own any Rolex, that's fine. That's not a problem. But we can appear in public and both have enough money to buy ourselves decent clothes so we can look at each other as social equals. There are civic spaces where we can come together and have a debate and we'll actually listen to each other. We both have a chance to influence politics. And it's not the case that because the guy with Rolexes is a billionaire, he can just buy political decisions. So there are all of those things about what makes us equals in the important sense, not in the sense of how many Rolexes do you have, but in the sense of political voice, of social equality, of inequality, of status in the eyes of others, and having common experiences of talking together, of debating together, of being fellow citizens. I think thinking about creating those positive spaces is really important to overcoming this sort of distance that you currently see both from the right and the left. Mm.
Well, yeah, that requires an equalizing narrative because we are capable of stratifying no matter what happens. Scott, I remember being on Hajj once on the pilgrimage to Mecca where you are forced to wear rags effectively.
Mm.
And you can spot the ones who wear the Calvin Klein rags and the ones who wear the towels from home. It's amazing how even in an environment of such forced equality of appearance as that, there is still a stratification. On that note, Yasha, we must leave it, I'm afraid. But thank you so much for staying up so late for us to speak to us because I know you're over in the UK at the moment. So thank you very much. Go to bed.
I will. My pleasure. This is a great discussion.
And look, just before Yasha goes, I really do commend to our audience Yasha's podcast, The Good Fight. It's a wonderful listen. Now, you may remember that The Mindfield recently celebrated 100 episodes. I thought that was impressive. But our little show is just a babe in the RN woods compared to our sister program, The Spirit of Things. Next month, The Spirit of Things is celebrating 20 years on the religious front line with a new monthly series called 2020. Rachel Connell will be bringing you highlights from their enormous back catalog, tracing two decades of tumultuous change. The 2020 series is kicking off Sunday, the 30th of July, with the search for an authentic Australian spirituality and the years leading up to the year 2000, when people were running for cover, predicting the apocalypse. You can listen to The Spirit of Things on air, online, or through the ABC radio app.